It's January 29th, 2003, and I'm at 806 Main in La Grande. We're speaking today with Jack Evans, who is our narrator. We're going to be talking about a number of things today, focusing somewhat on architectural issues in and around La Grande, and in fact, Jack's house. Maybe we'll have time to return to that. At 806 Main is itself a La Grande landmark, having been built in 1892, and Jack has done a lot of remodeling and restoring on this house. We maybe return to that later. But Jack, I thought today maybe to begin, maybe talk about downtown issues, the new town of La Grande. You had mentioned was punctuated, the building of downtown buildings was punctuated by some fires, and would you want to kind of start there as a starting point a little bit?
As good a place as any. The old town of La Grande was established the spring and summer of 1862, and it was La Grande until the railroad came through in 1884. Daniel Chaplin, who staked out the first land claim in what is now La Grande, in Old Town, he ended up, I think, with 320 acres, but at any rate, when the railroad came through, he offered them 105 acres for the purposes of establishing a division plant here, and thereby nosed out Union and North Powder as being candidates for a division plant. This was an ideal place for them to set up marshaling yards and make up the trains that locally based engines would boost over the Blue Mountains. Business of developing the town was turned over to some people in Portland after it had been platted, the various properties, and of course land speculators bought up lots of property, and it changed hands numerous times in 1884 and into 1885, but by that time the town was pretty well established already, the new one, and a number of people, most of the businesses, immediately moved down to Trackside and built frame buildings to house all of these operations. Unfortunately, being a wooden town, it had the same problem that others did, and it burned out the first time in 1886. The fire started in the back of Jay Brooks's clothing store and jumped the Adams Avenue. He was on the south side of Adams. It jumped the street, and following that, I think it burned seven blocks, six or seven. Anyway, nearly all of the town that had been built at that time, and this included the railroad depot, which had been finished in 1884. So the town was only 2 years old when the fire occurred. They rebuilt it immediately and began using brick. The principal building in the new town was a big brick one put up by Aaron Sommer. Sommer was a merchant who had a store, a clothing store, primarily in Old Town, and he moved down to the New Town, put up the brick building, and also had his house moved down to the New Town. It is a large white one, and it was on 4th Street, I think. It is visible in the old 1875 photograph of La Grande. But anyway, Sommer had it moved down to the intersection of 4th and Depot Streets, and it sat there for quite a long time. After the fire, the downtown section was immediately rebuilt, and more brick buildings were put up. It still, I think, had a predominance of frame buildings. There is a very nice picture taken, I think, from the top of a grain elevator. It was taken in 1889 that shows a view of the downtown area looking west. And in it, a few brick buildings are visible. But of all the buildings that are in it, only one, Aaron Sommer's house, was there at the time, but I don't think it shows. This picture was taken in 1889. But of all the buildings that are there in that picture, only one survives today, and that's a brick house on 4th Street where Nettie Bushnell lived for many years. It's still there. And it was, I don't know who the original owner was, It was the house that Dr. Molitor lived in the latter part of the last century, that is, the 19th century.
Where is that house?
It's just over here on 4th. Yeah, it's a brick house. It's right next door to, on the north, to Lester Real Estate's house.
Okay.
That big Sears Roebuck house.
Yep.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's right next door to that on the north. Mm-hmm. And it shows in a couple of the early mm-hmm. photos of the mm-hmm. town. But everything else in that picture, all those buildings are gone. And in that picture, the Presbyterian Church is there, so it had to be taken after 1888, and I'm sure it was the summer of 89. But the Presbyterian Church, of course, was replaced by a brick one, I think, around 1928 or 9. I have that date somewhere. But anyway, the town then prospered for a while until the 4th of July, 1891. And at 8 o'clock in the evening, a fire started in the Blue Mountain Hotel's kitchen. And this building was on the south side of Washington, where the Elks Lodge is today. And again, there was wind, and it jumped the street and burned a little over four blocks, the two blocks immediately north, and then the two blocks north and east. So that Aaron Sommer came back up from Portland and put up a new building where the other brick one had been. That is the Sommer building that exists today. It was put up in the fall of 91 and then remodeled to a more modern appearance in 1916. And across the street to it on the east, the northeast corner of Adams and Depot, was the Rogers building. Rogers had put up a drugstore there in 1888, and his business burned. And he built another one, a much bigger building, and the building still exists, although it's been pretty heavily remodeled since then.
It's currently the building that's at Adams and Depot.
Yeah, it was, after they remodeled it, they called it the Phoenix Building.
Oh, okay, it's the one across the street from Red Cross Drug. It's being currently remodeled mm-hmm. in 2003, yeah.
The address of it, and that was the address of Rogers' drugstore, after the numbering process started, which was early 90s, it was 1201 Adams and still is. And that was the last major fire. When Sommer was here putting up his replacement building, he also built another one in a burnt-out block, and that's the Sommer Hotel, which is still standing just across from the post office. And then after that, there weren't any really serious fires like several blocks. There have been others that were one building or part of a block since then, and the other more or less spectacular one of the 19th century was the Pacific Company's grain elevator, which burned in 1893. It was then the tallest building in Le Grand at I think 95 feet, and it was the lot where it was is still empty. It was right across the street to the west from what for many years was Le Grand Lumber Company, and is now occupied by Miller's Home Center.
Right.
It was Van Patten's for a long time, and I think it was the Wenaha Lumber Company in 1917. The building goes back a long way and has always been a lumber yard. They're prone to fire. You would think that would have been gone a long time ago, but it's held up pretty well.
Well, you mentioned that part of the building, I guess I was going back to brick, after the fires, they started more brick, you were saying, more brick structures came in.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that there were some early architects. Now, Mr. Thornton, you had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Would he, you might want to talk about him a little, would he have been involved in, would any of these brick buildings been involved in any architectural planning, or would they have been just more or less, you know, thrown together by people to get like a two-story storefront type of thing built? Do you think there was some architectural design and planning involved once they started building in brick?
Probably to some extent. I imagine, in a sense, there would have been when they were using wood. The person who desired the building would give the architect an idea of what arrangement was needed and what kinds of spaces were required. and then the architect would do a sketch, and they would talk about it. It's very much as it is today, probably a little less formal. When Calvin Thornton drew up the blueprints for the Mormon church here, which unfortunately is also gone, those were all done in pencil.
That was the Mormon church, which is now where the Observer building
it was
is now.
The Observer is now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A very nice building. The problem that LDS had with it was that it was designed for a pedestrian population, and there was no parking.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a large congregation, so they didn't have much choice, really, but to relocate. And, of course, you can't very well relocate a large brick building. So they did save, I think, stained glass out of it and the organ, and that was about it. It was a nice building. Thornton, in that design, he also designed the old Baptist church, which was also brick and stone, and it was built in 1907. And I think the Mormon church was also 1907, so late in his life. Thornton, and I have, I've got quite a lot of material on him, which give his birth dates, which I have forgotten at the moment. But he was self-taught, I think. I don't believe he went to an architecture school. His designs have a kind of individual quality about them that he wasn't making statements, as a lot of modern people do. They will design something impractical just so it'll be noticed. I think he was trying to design elegant buildings that people could use. But I think he was largely self-taught, because before he came here, he had a drugstore over in Weezer. And then, I have no idea how he got his training, but he had some engineering ability and quite a bit of architectural talent. I think he came here in 1889, which would have been the right time to start contributing what he could do to the area. And over the course of the next 20 years, he designed a great many buildings downtown, some of which are still standing. The Rogers Building is one. The Ralston Building on the opposite corner, where Lawrence's Jewelry is located, and it was remodeled to a more modern appearance around 1920. But it was one of his buildings. I think the bank where Mac and Sons is now, or has been, that was one of his, because it was a very interesting design that I don't think it would have come from the pen of anybody else. He, I think, designed the Sommer Hotel, probably. He might have designed the Foley Hotel. He liked that style of architecture. It was, styles of the era are given various names. Most of his architecture, I think, somebody might disagree with me, was what they would have called Romanesque Revival. It went out of style about 1891 in other parts of the country, but it seems to have held on here for a while. And it, and some of the business buildings, they refer to the detail as being Queen Anne, but I think the only reason they do might be that some of the buildings had turrets on the corners. The Isaac Rand in Baker City has turret on the corner, and the Foley Hotel had one too. But mostly those were Italianate designs, and it was at a time when the rusticated stone and the brick and the round arches or segmented arches or combinations of them were quite popular. And these gave a hint of classical design, but they were, I think, more Romanesque than anything else. And they, at least as I have studied the architectural styles here, they would have included probably the Slater Building. Slater Building is on the corner of Fur and Jefferson, and it's the one with the elaborate metal front on the Jefferson Street side.
Yes, I was going to ask you, is that on the National Register of Historic Places?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, I put it on for, I think, for Bill Geddes when he had the building. It's been quite a few years ago now.
Yeah.
I couldn't find the architect listed anywhere, but I'm pretty sure that it must have been Thornton.
Yeah.
The detailing looks like his work.
So is that what would be called an iron front building, or is it iron, or is it?
It's sheet metal. Largely.
Sheet metal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Those were done by a company in St. Louis. old age is getting me. I'll think of the name pretty soon. It's a well-recorded one, and Arthur Hart, who for a long time was the head of the Historical Society in Boise, has done quite a study of the surviving buildings with these Mesker brothers, metal fronts on them. There's a very fine one down in Silverton, and there are others with pieces of metal fronts, you know, like say a laboratory or a bay window or a real fancy cornice or something like that, or other design on the front.
How is that Mesker spelled?
M-E-S-K-E-R.
M-E-S-K-E-R.
Yeah, Mesker Brothers, St. Louis.
St. Louis. And there was also something called Iron Front. I remember growing up in Montana seeing a few of those. That was
those were more from the 1860s.
Yeah, that's when this building I was thinking of in Helena was built.
There are a lot of them on the I think 1st and 2nd Avenues in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few of the Iron Fronts still surviving.
Mm-hmm.
They're all from the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some of them done by the Portland Iron Works, I think. One of the two of the buildings downtown have old plinths and pilasters along one side that are cast iron, and some of those were done over in Baker City. So any place you could have a foundry established, and if you're any good at sand casting, you could come up with building parts for people who needed them.
Mm-hmm. So, but in this case, what we had here was something with sheet metal that was as a front.
What they produced were all kinds of components, that is, colonnades, colonnettes, friezes, plinths, brackets, cornices, parapets, everything you might need on a building, and framing for windows. And then the designs, the stuff, the components were all interchangeable so that you could combine them in a multitude of different ways. And the buildings didn't all have to look alike, you see. So we had a lot of fun with them.
It was almost like a new style in a way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could take elements of an older style and mix and match. And
take an Erector set or a Lego set or a Lincoln Log set, and using these standardized components to come up with your own combinations.
So it was kind of an offshoot of the Romanesque tradition, or kind of a new...
The front on that one, I would say, is more Italianate than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mesker developed them during the 1870s and 80s, and they were continued up into this century. Well, not this one, but the immediate past, up into the 19th century. But I think that they were based more on Italianate Renaissance designs.
Mm-hmm.
But the Meskers were attempting to design relatively fireproof buildings. And if you had a metal front on your building, you had a lower insurance rate. And the old Sanborn fire insurance atlases, which are the best city plans we have of the period, they were color-coded and keyed so that the building was indicated as being of brick or with a metal roof or metal-sided or whatever to indicate how much of a risk it was to have it. Well, thanks, Dorothy.
Well, we were chatting about buildings there. So go back to that.
Yeah, this I think what we last mentioned was the Slater Building, which is LeGrand's only metal front building, really.
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about. Okay, go ahead.
It, I believe that Slater designed it, and I think it's probable, or not Slater, that Thornton designed it. It is the Slater Building, and it was owned originally, and the man responsible for it was James H. Slater, who had been congressman and had been an attorney down in Salem for a long time. He and his family came west in wagon train in 1853, I believe. But anyway, he moved up here in the 70s, and when he put up the building, he built it as a commercial on the ground floor, offices upstairs arrangement, and the offices were occupied by himself and two of his sons, who were in partnership with him, James D. Slater, and the other one was Robert. And they the partnership lasted, I imagine, until J.H. died. Robert went over to Pendleton and practiced there, and James D. took over the practice here. There was another son who was sort of a maverick in a sense because he didn't take up the law. He became a builder, and he built Riveria School, among other structures around, and he built this house that we're sitting in. He listed himself as a contractor for a long time, and then later years listed himself as an architect, so he apparently had some architectural training to go along with that. The Slater building was still occupied by James D. Slater and until the West Jacobson building downtown was completed in 1913. It is still there and still in use. And he moved to it as soon as it was available, because by that time Jefferson was not a terribly good location, and something on Adams was preferable. But it's a good building. I'm glad that we have it. There aren't too many of them left. There was one other building downtown that had a largely metal front. It was the one where the Imperial was, and the second floor had a great big sheet metal bay window, Royal window, and above that a very elaborate metal cornice with a gabled pediment. It was a fancy thing. There are a few pictures of it. It burned not too awfully many years ago, I think in the 70s.
And where was it?
It's where the Long Branch is now.
Oh, okay.
And now it's just a little block building in between the two brick ones. But in its heyday, there was a brothel upstairs and a restaurant downstairs, which was not an uncommon combination. And handsome building front, very handsome front on it.
That would have been built probably in the 90s as well.
Yeah, it was from the 90s, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, close to the railroad. And your house, which we can come back to later, was 1892.
Mm-hmm. The fall of 1892.
So there must have been quite a lot of building, obviously in the 90s, it sounds like, all over town.
Well, mostly, I think.
Downtown.
Well, it didn't. It was a long time before Old Town and New Town grew together, before it filled in between. But the area that was the residential part of Chaplin's addition to LeGrand, and also Green Arnold's, that was Chaplin's brother-in-law who had a claim also, it was everything west of 4th and up to, say, maybe Walnut, filled in pretty quickly. And a lot of that up into the 1920s, and quite a lot of that was more prestigious housing than you'd find in some of the less expensive residential areas. Main Avenue, where this house is located, was one of the better quality streets of the time. So was Spring and Washington. And LeGrand at one time had a Park Avenue. The names of things change. Washington was always Washington, but where the diagonal part of it ends at 4th Street, you cross the street and then you can go on up Washington, which is east-west, as traditional streets are. And at that point, where you crossed 4th, it became Park Avenue. And it was Park as far up as it went. And this got to be a nuisance, I think, to too many people. And by the 1890s of it, some blocks of it were referred to as Washington. And then by early 1900s, it was all Washington. So Park disappeared. Some of the streets have been renamed or changed. I can't think of any that were markedly different. There was O Street, O Avenue, and then the next one is Penn. They probably didn't want to call it P Street for obvious reasons.
Right, right.
Q was also avoided, but R and S, of course, are commonly used.
And it goes down, I think, to Z, doesn't it? It goes all the way to Z.
All the way to Z, and then something else has to be substituted.
Mm-hmm.
Where you get into confusing situations is where you run out of numbers or you run out of alphabet, and then you have to fudge a little, as in some of the developments, where all of the streets have names, and this makes it a little difficult. I often refer to what I consider a joke about Salem. Church and street are not separated in Salem. Church and state are not separated in Salem. They intersect a block west of the Capitol.
You're right. Yeah, right. That's good. Well, so there must have been a period then, at least in that time, when the main residential area was still up around C and B in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And then people would come down to, after the railroad came in, they would come down forth to shop and whatever.
Some of them even commuting.
People would live up there and work down here.
As long as the Oregon Trail functioned, and this would be even after it became the government road in 1861, which was actually just before the town itself started, the Oregon Trail was B Avenue, and it went up over the hill to the west. And it was not until, I think, the late 1860s that the Meacham Brothers Toll Road was built all the way down the ground, down the Grand Ronde Canyon, so that you could go that way and not have to climb a mountain and then descend it again. But the at that time, B Avenue was the street with the stables and the warehouses and so forth, because it was on the Oregon Trail, the main road. And then C Avenue was the business district of Old LeGrand, extending from 1st, roughly, to 4th or 5th. Not a very large business district, not a very large population, but it was a pretty thriving little community.
And the coming of the railroad, as it did to so many places in the West, changed all that, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, it did. In the 1860s, the old road coming down Ladd Hill, which was extremely difficult to come down and even worse to get back up, became a handicap because Union started in 1862, also a few months after LeGrand did. And it was, in a sense, better located. And in 1864, I believe, Jim Pyle laid out his road at Pyle's Canyon. And that was a much easier route, even though it was knee-deep in mud or hip-deep or chin-deep in some places in the spring. It was still a better road by far. And there is a notice in one of the 1868 newspapers calling for volunteer labor. People from LeGrand wanted volunteers to put a better road up Ladd Hill. LeGrand was losing out on all of the trade, or a lot of it, because of poor access to the community. So that was done, and I think it helped matters to some extent. LeGrand got his big boost partly because Chaplin had the foresight to get the division point established here. But Union, at that time, I think maybe by 1870-something, it was pretty much a rival for LeGrand, and had also become the county seat in the election at that time. The problem being that the people in halfway Richland area, which was in a strip of land that hadn't been taken from Baker County, it was known as the Panhandle later after Wallowa County was taken off. That area had quite a little population for the time, and they already had 50 miles to go to get to Union. They didn't want to go another 15 to get to LeGrand. So, and the Cove sided with Union. So as it turned out, Union got the county seat and retained it until 1904. And this bothered LeGrand a little. At least the business center was in Union. However, the railroad came through. The city fathers in Union were approached by the surveyor if for a little consideration he would locate the railroad right through Union. And the principal banker, I think Mr. Eaton, said, well, this is the shakedown. We don't need to do this. You're going to have to come through here anyway. And the surveyor said, fine. And he ran it up the other side of the valley so that they Union didn't have access to the railroad after all, and they had to put in Union Junction and then build a short line railroad into the town of Union. So that handicapped Union a little bit. Sometimes these errors that are not seen clearly at the time can cause changes in years ahead that aren't anticipated.
Yeah, foresight is not always automatic in these cases, is it? I'm going to pause for just a moment
Hindsight is usually at least two-thirds regret.
Right. Good point. I'd like to turn just for a moment or for a few minutes to some questions about residences to homes that began to be built down in the area of Newtown. And you'd mentioned one house in particular that you think is the oldest residence still standing in LeGrand. Do you want to...
Yeah, that's Aaron Sommer's house. I think I mentioned that he moved it down to the intersection of Depot and Adams, or Depot and Fourth. And in later years, the house was moved again. This was in, probably 1912. I think the Methodist Church must have acquired the land that it sat on. And it was moved to a point on Spring Street facing south, just across from the Methodist Church. The new Methodist Church was erected at that site in 1913. And I don't think they had intended to run Spring Street through because there wasn't really room for it. But later they did run it through, and that's why part of it is one way and is only one lane wide, really. And I think this was kind of an afterthought. But the Methodist Church, when that was put in, my Aaron Sommer's house moved across the street, and it now belongs to Tim and Laura McManus. I think it's the oldest house in LeGrand. It was built in 1872.
Yeah, and it's sitting where right now?
Could easily get the address. It's
4. It's on 4.
Kind of something Spring.
Oh, it's on Spring.
Yeah. It's two houses west of Lester Real Estate's building.
Okay, so it's west on Spring. It would be kind of across Spring from the Methodist Church parking lot in that area, right?
Yeah, large white house.
Okay.
It was the biggest one in Old Town and still a big house. It's still a big house.
Built in 1872.
I think so.
So that's 130 years old or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
I'm sure that was what Clara McManus, Tim's father, who had the house at that time, I'm sure that's what he told me. It was built in 72.
And that's a frame house?
That's frame house. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Blue, old-style balloon framing, which is a little different than the modern balloon frame construction. Hmm. Modern balloon frame construction, you... build a wall one floor high, let's say an 8-foot wall, and you stand those up, lay a platform on top of it, and put up another 8-foot wall, a chunk at a time on top of that. The original balloon frame construction starts at the foundations, and the studs are as tall as the house. And they're put up and kind of scabbed together so that they'll stand, and then the floor joists are nailed into the studs. So that the house, it's a different kind of a skeleton, but it's still a frame house. Then the fire stops and sway braces and so forth are put into the walls. But your wall, say if it's 30-foot high wall, why the wall is probably hollow all the way to the bottom if you don't put in fire stops. And most of those houses had them. They were well aware that fire going up the inside of a wall could get away in a hurry.
What kind of material was used for the fire stop?
Just ordinary two-by-fours. They were all rough two-by-fours at that time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It would stop the draft.
Yeah, just something to stop the draft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in those days, you didn't have wiring yet, and so you didn't have to do any boring or drilling or threading or anything. And until we got a water system, the plumbing was pretty rudimentary, too. Once those things came along, then they were retrofitted later with the wiring and the plumbing.
Mm-hmm. Once electricity arrived and plumbing and so on.
Early 90s. I think we had electricity here by 91, and I think they got a decent water system that they could use for firefighting shortly after the second big fire, somewhere right along, early 90s.
There would have been an incentive there, incentive for that.
Sure.
Are there other older homes that might now be standing still in the community?
The brick one I have mentioned that's over here on 4th.
On 4th, right.
It was probably built in 1884.
That's the one next door to Lester Real Estate on 4th.
I'm sure it was built about 1884. Mm-hmm. The other is there are some up in Old Town that were probably built in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It would be hard to tell, and a lot of them have been rebuilt several times, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing much to indicate what they were originally. There was one that somebody... I think she said the house she lived in was built in 1876, she thought. But most of them are later houses, and some are the older ones that have been rebuilt. But I don't, you'd have to research the history of every single house in order to be sure about these things. And the assessor's office guesses at them usually and says about 1890 or about 1900 or whatever. But if you, there was a time when any time you bought a piece of property, you got a nice thick abstract that gave the complete history of it. All the hands it had passed through and everything else, clear back to the beginning when it was first sold from sale of state lands or whatever. But that hasn't been done for a long time. They simply check the records and you get title insurance, they guarantee that it's... clear, free and clear, which is the main consideration. So for the history, you have to do some research on that, both at the courthouse and in the abstract and title company or some other firm that handles titles.
At least that information is available if people wanted to do the research.
If you want to research mm-hmm. your house, it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this one, I've been lucky in many respects. It's only had a few owners. The people who originally built it in 1892, there is a record of who they were and what business the man was in. And then after the, Mrs. Conkey, when the house was built, she took out a loan from the bank. $700 to be paid off, $100 a year. In 1899, it was paid for, and I don't know what part of the original cost it was or where some of that came from. The house cost $1,800 to build. But once that once it was paid off, then she sold it to the bank.
She sold the house to the bank?
Mm-hmm. Not exactly to the bank, in a sense. The bank, La Grande National Bank, later First National, at that time, they seem to have owned quite a bit of property around. But anyway, she sold it to the cashier of the bank, F.L. Myers, and he lived in it until 1908. And at that time, he moved into a big house that still stands up on Spring, First and Spring. And this house then was owned by the bank until 1920. They seem to have rented it out during that period. Then in 1920, it was... sold to the Motes family, who had it until 1961, so it's 40 years, you see. And then we bought it from the guy that it was sold to, who fixed it up somewhat, and we've had it 42 years or so.
Yeah.
41.
How do you spell the name of the family who built the house?
Conkey, C-O-N-K-E-Y.
Hmm, okay.
Charles and Laura Conkey.
And then Slater designed it.
Built
it.
He built it. The little squib in the paper said that Charles Conkey is going to put up an $1,800 house and John Slater is going to build it for him. I have no idea who designed it. Calvin Thornton might have. The floor plan is a little odd in some respects, which makes me think that it probably didn't come out of the plan book.
Well, do you want to talk just a little bit about this so-called Victorian style? Because would you call that this house that style?
Yeah, I guess technically, anything built between 1837 and 1901 is Victorian.
Seeing as how those were the years she was queen.
Right. And if you've got a house built 1901 or later, it's probably Edwardian, at least for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
The principal Victorian styles in America are the Gothic, there have been some more modern versions of that, but the regular Gothic, Victorian Gothic style is from the 1840s and 50s. And before that, it was Greek Revival, which is, they really do look like Greek temples, but all of them are back east, or there are a few in the Willamette Valley.
This is with lots of columns and things like that.
Yeah, the fancy portico with the gable pediment and dental trees and the, well, usually they're Doric columns, but some of them are Ionic and some are Corinthian. But those are all down in the Willamette Valley. There's nothing like that around here. The ones that do have columns are all much later, and they're Classical Revival or Colonial Revival. The next one, in most cases, is after Gothic, is the Renaissance Revival, which they're usually big square houses with round top windows and bracketed gables or bracketed eaves. And generally, they don't have gables. They generally have a hip roof. Or a flat roof even in some places. And there are a lot of those down around Portland. And they date from the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. By the late 80s, they were starting to put up Queen Anne houses, which generally had towers and with conical roofs and fancy porch work and a veranda that goes partway around the house. And so the smaller porches that were earlier. And then this house is in the style, it's a version of Queen Anne, it's called East Lake. The East Lake has to do with some of the trim that's on it. And the trim on this one shows the influence of, the infatuation with the Japanese print that went on for a long time late in the last century. We have a Chinese porch, that is, the railing is an Oriental appearing design.
And as you said, you were able to, when you bought the house, you were able to preserve a number of these features because, in time, because they might have been remodeled, so-called remodeled away. They would have disappeared.
Yeah, the fellow who had bought the house was doing some modernization, some of which was desirable in a way, but he had gotten a little too far with it, some of it, and he hadn't gone as far as he wanted to do with others. But we saved the porch, which he would have taken off, and some other things. So I feel very lucky to have gotten a good Victorian house. I always liked them. Mm-hmm. But the a lot of them have been changed a great deal. And I was going to mention something about the bay window. Most of them have bay windows. And back in the 1850s, when Downing was designing houses, and these were the Gothic, some of the Gothic ones, they all had bay windows, and he referred to those as conservatories. They were a place to put your potted plants. That's what they were for. They're also an awfully good place to set a Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So you have here in the front, you have the one bay window in your front parlor.
Right.
You call it the front parlor.
Uh-huh. Well, this was probably, I suppose that was just the parlor. The sliding doors lead into the room we're sitting in, and I think this was always a dining room. And across the hall was a bedroom, and the room south of here was a bedroom. There was an open porch there on the east side, which was enclosed during the 1930s, I think, 30s or 40s, and it was used as a sleeping porch, and now it is part of the sitting room, which is what the back bedroom has been turned into. One interesting thing about the design, it had a bathroom built into it before the plumbing was available. I think they knew the plumbing was going to be here pretty quick. And there is a private passage that goes from from the bedroom back to the kitchen, and the bathroom is off of it. It was also available through a separate door. There were an awful lot of doors in the house, and I guess this was common. But the private passage was a closet you could walk through all the way. And one reason for this was that they didn't have clothes hangers yet, at least as a common thing. And so there was a strip of batten down each side of the hall with hooks in it, and you hung your coats and shirts and so forth on those as you would on pegs. So the that has since become a closet and a little place for the vanity in the bathroom, but that was the way it was originally. Kitchen was nearly all doors, and the man we got the house from remodeled it. It was pretty much still a 19th century kitchen, you know. And he put in an island and some other things, but it wasn't big enough really to take that kind of conversion. It wasn't a really large room like a lot of the old kitchens were. It was just a place where there was a pantry to keep the dishes in, and a sink in the corner, and then probably a work table in the middle of the room, and the big old range on the wall and the water tank. And it had a wood lift that went down to the basement. That's no longer there, but there was one. So that you ended up with all doors. All the meals, of course, were served in the dining room. If you want to eat in the kitchen and socialize, it wasn't really ideal for that purpose. There was a narrow little porch that fronted on the alley, so it was always dirty. And when we remodeled the kitchen, we took in the back porch. So that gave us an extra 3 feet, and now it's a sizable room. It's nice to sit around the table out there. So I would say this is a modernization that increased the comfort. The back pantry was ideal for putting the washer and dryer and this kind of thing, and the outside entrance is now out there. So it has evolved while we've been in it. I've tried to save as much as I could of what was attractive and bring back some of the things that weren't here any longer.
Well, you've done a great deal of the work yourself, I think.
Quite a bit.
Over the years.
There were some things, of course, that had to be done. You have professionals do things like furnaces, mm-hmm. and of course we've had several of those over the years, and the new roofs and this kind of thing. Those are best done professionally, I think. Things you could do would take too long.
Right, but you would call this house then a Queen Anne style, or a modified Queen Anne style?
Yes, modified Queen Anne. It's Queen Anne, and I guess the decorative style would be Eastlake, probably. Mm-hmm. That's a reflection of Charles Eastlake, who was a tastemaker of the 1870s and 80s, who preached a return to simple designs, and his what he get rid of all these curves, you know, and let's get things to basic shapes. And he was, I think, more thinking along the lines of Morris and, kind of the,
You mean the English designer?
Yeah.
Morris.
Yeah, and some of the others who were doing the term for what their school escapes me for the moment. But it was a return to simplified. They went to medieval styles.
Oh, the pre-Raphaelites.
Pre-Raphaelites.
The pre-Raphaelites. Yeah. Right. That's
yeah. Rossetti, you know, and so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
And Eastlake, I think, reflected their temperament pretty much. But over here, his style was interpreted a little differently. We had had the curves of the Renaissance Revival furniture with the lots of carving and the crests up on top and all that. So what we ended up with is we changed to a new style, Eastlake style, but it was the same furniture with the same kind of wood and everything, except it was square across the top. We just got rid of some of the curves. So it still stayed elaborate and Victorian.
So, but actually then you have tried to find furniture, in other words, that matches the style as much as you can.
Up to a point and in a way. The styles that we like best are Renaissance Revival. There's a table in there. And Eastlake, here, this is a fair example of it right here, a little late. But the styles that were probably used in 1892 when this house built were likely golden oak, which is a little bit past the Eastlake style. And I would imagine golden oak would have been primarily what the Conkeys had. I don't know. But I like walnut better, and this is just a matter of personal preference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the styles were some just about as intricate as the others. The sideboard here is probably more Queen Anne than Eastlake in that the decoration is simpler. It's not quite so... Not quite so fussy.
Not quite so ornate.
Yeah, not quite so fussy.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about one other building in town, just briefly today, and that would be the LeGrand's Carnegie Library. And if you wanted to talk, I mean, right now as we speak, there's plans for a new library are apparently in the works, but just wanted to ask about the whole Carnegie idea, his mission to build libraries, and how that impacted a town like LeGrand.
He influenced an awful lot of learning and refinement and education all over the country with what he did. Carnegie, like a lot of other people of his generation, came over here with nothing from the old country, that was in case Scotland, and in those days you could really do what the Horatio Alger books were all about, that is, by dint of hard work, succeed. Horatio Alger always fudged a little bit. His hero always married the boss's daughter. But Carnegie made it in his own on his own merits. But having made his fortune, he did engage in some kinds of philanthropy, and he may have been a tough old boy, but he did do a lot for the country. And the bigger the city, the bigger the library. Union has a Carnegie Library, LeGrand has one, a lot of other towns have them. They are pretty good buildings, and they serve their purpose very well. The problem that they have today is that they are not designed for our time, and you have to adapt them, and in some cases you have to adapt them so much that it's better not to do it. And they become other buildings. The one in Baker City has been an art center for a long time. It's nice when it's got classical columns, and it's artsy of sandstone, I think, or tuff anyway. Maybe tuff. But the one here is, they have done, I think, a very fine job of keeping it operable. And they have managed to adapt for handicapped access and other things. But there is a kind of a limit to how far you can go, and especially with all the electronic capabilities we have to have today, you almost have to have a new building, and I think that's the only way to go. And I like very much the idea of what they're apparently going to be doing. The old building, it still has some problems, and I don't know what it will be used for. One of the curses of our civilization is that a flat roof is the most practical in terms of building materials. They should all be gabled, I think. Then they wouldn't leak quite as badly. But there are always roof leaks. And this one suffered because somebody, it was a matter of poor judgment, or I guess maybe ignorance, they tried to improve the appearance by sandblasting the walls. And this takes all the glaze off of the bricks and makes them soak up water like a sponge, so that the water migrates through to the inside of the building. And that has damaged it pretty considerably. So I don't know. The city has, I think, done some really good things in the way of strengthening the structure and making it more lasting. What will happen to it in the long run, I don't know. It was made for a different kind of user, in a way, being built in 1913. It has a fireplace in the west end, and I imagine a cheerful fire in there on a winter day would be very attractive. The fireplace is covered up, and may not be usable anymore, probably isn't. But it, as to what might be done with it after it ceases to be a library, I don't really know.
It would be good. Hopefully, it would be nice to see it used in the way the one in Baker City is, as a gallery. Mm-hmm. I know in Pendleton they have a much larger structure. I'm not sure if the old one was a Carnegie or not, but that one is.
I don't believe so.
I don't know if it was. No, I don't think so either.
There was. I remember the name of the architect. It was a Portland architect, I think, that designed it.
That's a very interesting building.
Yes,
and that's
it is.
Been preserved, I think, as a gallery or something. A
I
gallery
believe so.
Or museum.
It was roomy and had some very progressive things in the design for its time. But again, industrial progress, I guess you would call it, has outdistanced it, and it was beyond adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to do something with it, but fortunately they saved it.
They were able to convert
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's a good building, and they were able to use
conversion,
it.
And hopefully we can do that here, and it's a very interesting structure.
Hope so too.
I was going to ask you briefly before we stop for today. I just wanted to ask briefly about one other building, and that's I guess it's an apartment now. It's what we call the Castle up on Second.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
What would you call that with all its?
It's an interesting one. It's Queen Anne.
Yeah. Okay.
It's Queen Anne, but it's a very late one. When W.H. Bodenkamp had that house built, I have no idea who the architect was. When he had the house built, I believe it was 1907. And this is at the very end of the Victorian styles. Nearly everything that was coming on at that time was either bungalow style, arts and crafts, or the bungalow, or classical revival, colonial revival. I could say something about, maybe I should say something about Sears Roebuck. Not that it has anything to do with that one.
That would be a good one to talk about, too.
The thing that gives the castle away as being really a late one is the railing around the porch. Those are Corinthian columns. It's a classical revival porch, you see. And there are Palladian windows up above. That is a central window with a window on either side of them. And there are some other touches that show that this is in the colonial revival era, which is from 1890s, late 1890s, on to 1920. And it's Queen Anne House with all kinds of colonial revival touches. The big houses up on the hill that have the wide porches with the columns, and Helms Place is one. Former Reynolds Place across the street to the south is another. Those are colonial revival houses. And the less ambitious ones are some like, over on Washington, our son lives in one. It's got a colonnaded porch across the front, but it isn't a bungalow. It's more of a colonial revival house than a bungalow. So the castle is maybe the last of its kind. And interestingly enough, Mr. Bodenkamp had a number of children, but by the time he built it, they were getting, I think, not too far from grown. And I believe that by 1912, it had been converted to apartments, which is very early. There's a lot of original stuff in it. It would be a fun one to restore. It'd be nice to restore that one. Ceilings have been lowered, and above them, why, the plaster has been all torn up by heating pipes being run every which way, and so forth. You'd have to convert a lot of things. There's a big fireplace in the front parlor, which is walled up. And they did finally locate the corner lights and the transom sash for the front entrance and get them put in, which look really nice. But it would be a fun house to do something with. It was the only. I think there have only been two genuine mansions in La Grande. It's one of them.
What's the other one?
The other one is the Stang house.
Stang. How would you describe that house?
Charles Miller, the architect, and it was his first big commission here. He described it as being a combination of colonial and federal. And you can see the federal designs in the design elements in it. It's a house that could have been built around 1820.
Mm-hmm. When was that house actually built? Do you know approximately?
I think it was finished 1923.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Stang was a lumberman from Wisconsin, I believe, who came out here, and he was in the night here quite a bit earlier than that, buying timber, and he established the Mount Emily Lumber Company. And which is now Boise Cascade's La Grande plant. And he put up that house, I think, 1923. Interesting man. He did some nice things for La Grande in 1912. He wanted shady streets. He liked shade, and he was in the Midwest, so he imported a large number of soft maples and planted them all up and down 2nd and 3rd and through this general area around here. And some of them are still standing. They're getting very large and old and rotten. They're not a long live tree, but they grew fast and produced abundant shade. And those were his gift to the city. He was an interesting man. And his house... They're not what you would expect in, say, a mansion. There's an indoor fountain in one of the rooms, and down in the basement there is a little theater with a stage and everything. The kids did theatricals down there.
Yes, I've been in the house a few times, but I've never really toured it. That's a very interesting
place. Yeah, I toured it a long time ago. 40 years ago, but that was before they had done anything to it. They preserved it very nicely. I don't think the fountain operates any longer. It wasn't operating then, but it was a nice little tile one, and their big sunroom. I think it's the north wing. Nice building.
Well, I think we're just about out for this for today. Should
okay.
We want to pause and
sure.
stop?